I learned that people can drink a lot in St. Patrick's Day and passed out drunk in the snow.
When you are at your end of your life, you just don't have time for crap. You just don't have time for small stuff. And you go right heart to heart.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Hinken.
And I'm Laura Wexler.
And this week on the podcast, Look for the Helpers, two stories about being of service in matters of birth and death.
And this first story is from Akemi Soru. She was born and raised in Mexico. She's half Japanese and half diehard Chilanga, which is how people from Mexico City are called. Akemi makes amazing pan muerto. She's a friend of mine, and she's a really wonderful person. I loved hearing this story, this backstory to the work that she does now. So take a listen.
20 years ago, I was turning 30, and somewhere I read this thing that said that the best experiences in life happen in your 30s. So I was like, ooh, what's going to happen? So excited. And yeah, the next year I met this gorgeous, the most intelligent and funniest guy, and he became my boyfriend. And pretty quickly we started talking about having a baby. So I went to crack the news to my dad, who was a fairly conservative Japanese Mexican. And he was weirdly happy about it. And when I went to give the news to my mom, who was kind of more progressive Mexican woman, she was weirdly not that happy, especially because we said we were not going to get married. Yeah. And we started trying, and a couple of months passed, and nothing happened. And then one day, my dad called and said that he had been sick, like a couple of weeks back. He had a pneumonia. But he was feeling better at that moment, and he was taking his medication and everything. But naturally, I wanted to go and visit him and check if everything was okay. So I took a bus 8 hours north from Mexico City to his mango orchard. And I saw him. He was doing pretty well. And we spent a couple of days, beautiful days, talking and eating. And the last day I was there, it was a Saturday. I just didn't want to go back. I wanted to stay a little bit longer. So I just didn't want to wake up early and go have breakfast with him. I stayed in bed. So when he was coming back from the kitchen, I heard this "Ay!" and boom, a bang in the door next to me. And I woke up and turned around and saw his legs. He was lying in the floor next to me. So I jumped out of the bed and went to check on him. I didn't know what was going on, so I started getting very nervous, panicking. I couldn't even check his vitals. So I went to look for someone to help me carry him to the car and take him to the nearest hospital that was 45 minutes from the orchard. And I tried to drive the car as fast as I could. I couldn't even drive. I started to cry. I don't even remember who drove that day. And halfway to the hospital, I knew something was very wrong because he was not breathing. When I got into the hospital, the doctor said that he had a massive heart attack. So basically, he was dead since the beginning. But I just couldn't process that. I spent weeks, probably months, trying to understand what happened, what could I have done. And I had a very, very bad PTSD. And 1 month later, it was the first month anniversary, I went to visit my sister in New York. It was St. Patrick's Day. And I learned that people can drink a lot in St. Patrick's Day. And passed out drunk in the snow. But also I learned that I was pregnant. Finally. So naturally, I had to prepare myself. I didn't want to go through a PTSD again. So I took all the classes that I could, like a CPR for babies class, childbirth education class, like the longest I could, like 20-hour childbirth education class. I hired a doula. I did everything I could. And the day came. And when I turned 32, I had my baby, my beautiful baby girl, that day. She's there. And a beautiful birth. So after that, I realized how much I enjoyed talking about births and labor and everything childbirth related. And then I had a second baby, and it was an amazing experience. So after that, I decided that I really wanted to become a doula. And that's what I did. I became a birth doula. Yeah. And a couple of births later, I was on call for one of my beautiful clients. She's like a sweet woman. And she had been on and off for many days, which is kind of normal, but it had been like she called me every other day to say like, oh, I'm having contractions, and then nothing. So that night, her husband called me and said like, seems like this time this is happening. And I was like, oh, okay, send me a screenshot of the contractions and I'll check. And when I saw the screenshot, I realized like this was happening and faster than I thought. So I called them back and I was like, you know what, you have to go to the hospital right now. Like, you have to go. And he said, we can't. I'm waiting for my parents. They're coming to take care of my oldest baby. And they're going to be here in around 20, 25 minutes. So, and I was like, no, you don't have that time. So I was like, okay, I'll be in your house in 6 minutes. Prepare yourself to leave in 6 minutes. And 6 minutes later, when I got into their house, and I saw her, and she transformed. She was transformed. She was like this ferocious Venus. And I was like, guys, you know what? We should just stay here, bring all the clean towels you have, and probably call an ambulance. But she knew she wanted to go to the hospital. She was like, no, I want to go. So I helped them go into the car. And that's when his parents came, and the dad drove us to the hospital as fast as he could. And I guess halfway to the hospital, she started like trying to push. So I was like, okay, wait. So I put her in the back seat and pulled her leggings out, and there she was, a beautiful baby girl. So again, I was in a car trying to rush as fast as I could to the hospital, trying not to panic. But this time I knew everything was going to be all right.
I really could see the, you know, those parallels between driving her father to the hospital and not being able to do anything, and then driving with this couple to have their child and feeling more like she wasn't panicking. And I love hearing people's origin stories for how they get into the work they're doing. And I think this one is really great. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back.
So this next story is from Tova Jessam. She's a wife, a mom of four teenagers, and she is a hospice worker who's been working with the critically ill for many, many years. So this is her origin story of how she got into that work and what it means to her. Take a listen.
So when I was in high school and college, I always thought that I knew what job I was going to do when I grew up. I was going to be a lawyer. So I prepared myself well, and I signed up for the LSAT, the prep course for taking the law exam before getting into law school, 2 hours away from my university, and I drove, and I took the preparation class so that I could do really well on the LSATs. And then I took the LSATs, and failed. The LSATs. I, essentially, don't think like a lawyer. So I thought to myself, now what? This was going to be my future. This was going to be who I was. I had taken philosophy of law and business law and sociology of law. What next? And I'm very grateful to a friend of mine at the time who said to me, Tova, I don't quite understand why you're having this existential angst. When I, in my church, we were developing a new church, we were trying to decide who should be a deacon. So what we did was we said, okay, there's two ways we can figure out who's going to be a deacon in our new church. We could create a job description and list all the qualities of a deacon and then find someone and say, hey, do you want to do this job description? Or we could find people who are already behaving like a deacon and say, hey, person who's doing this job already, would you like the title of a deacon? She said, Tova, what have you done for the last 4 years in university? I was like, okay, so start a campus chapter of Habitat for Humanity. And she's like, and what are you doing next year? I was like, oh, yeah, I'm already signed up to be a volunteer in Service to America. I'm going to Utah, and I'm going to work with battered women in Utah. But after that, I was going to go to law school. She's like, Tova, you already are a social worker. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's true. Okay, so now mind shift now, like a little less existential angst. But in the meantime, I went and saw the movie Philadelphia, which ages me, I know, because it was in the 90s. And I saw the movie with some friends, and after I saw the movie, I was just an emotional mess. I saw these people who were dying of AIDS, and they were isolated and alone, and I thought, well, how could that be? How could they be alone? Don't they have a community? Don't they have people who want to care for them? And I said to myself, when I get to Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah, I'm going to explore this more. And the way I explored what was interesting to me is I volunteered. So I'm working during the day as a battered women's shelter as a volunteer coordinator. But at night, I went to the Utah AIDS Foundation and became a volunteer to deliver meals to men dying of AIDS. Now in the 90s, before protease inhibitors, AIDS was a death sentence. So here I am showing up with my meal delivery partner to deliver meals to men who are dying of AIDS. And nice Jewish girl from New Jersey, really nothing in common, 21 years old, you know. And what I did have was an open heart and a willing soul. Because at this point in the 90s, people didn't really understand standard precautions and universal precautions. And people were afraid to get near people with AIDS because they thought, if I get too close, I'm also going to die. And I went and delivered meals, and I spent some time, 2 years I ended up doing this. And what I discovered with these amazing people were that when you're at your end of your life, you just don't have time for crap. You just don't have time for small stuff. And you go right heart to heart. And it was the most authentic relationships that I had had in my life in the quickest time. And they welcomed me into their lives, into their hearts, the caregivers, the men dying of AIDS. I went to funerals and I developed relationships. And it changed my heart. During these 2 years, my grandmother in Texas, who was on dialysis, got pneumonia. And I was called to go from Salt Lake to Texas, to Dallas, to visit her. And she said to me when I was with her, I'm tired. I'm really tired. Anybody who knows about dialysis, like everybody's half alive. And she was like, I'm just tired of being half alive. 3 days a week, it's just taking too much out of me. And my parents had divorced when I was young, and my grandmother had been an enormous stabilizing and important figure in my life. She had flown out to be in Jersey with my single mom for months on end, caring for us and being there for us. And she was one of the most stabilizing figures in my life growing up. And I was devastated. But somehow, in, again, 21, just remember, had the peace of mind to understand that I needed to tell her how important she was to me, that there might not be another chance. So for 8 days, I went in the morning and stayed all day and spent that time with my grandmother. And I searched my heart of hearts from side to side. and said everything that I felt like I needed to say to her about how important she was to me, how her visits, you know, what they meant to me and our relationship. And I said to myself, like, I may not see her alive again. I really was certain I would not, especially because she had sort of said she was giving up and she just didn't have that oomph for life anymore. And I did life review with my grandmother without even understanding what life review was. And I did relationship closure without even understanding what it was. But I somehow had the insight that if not now, when, there was no other opportunity. So I went home after 8 days to Utah, to Salt Lake City, to continue my work. And she died the next day. I got back on a plane, went back to Dallas, went to the funeral, and went to Shiva. And what I noticed at Shiva was that I was the one who had done this thing called anticipatory grieving, which now I know what it's called. I didn't know what it was called then. That I had spent 8 days preparing myself for her to die. And that I was in a place of peace and emotional settlement that no one else in my family was feeling. And I was like, oh, lucky me. That 8 days felt like a gift, felt like a blessing. So this combination ended up being the 1-2 punch, I should just say. Fast forward years later, I went to grad school, University of Maryland School of Social Work. During my time at University of Maryland, I volunteered at the Missionaries of Charity. Mother Teresa's had an AIDS hospice, not so far from here, actually, that I would go while I was in grad school and volunteer with people with AIDS. And when I was done graduating and I was trying to think, because thank God in social work, you can sort of be anyone you want to be and do anything you want to do. I had worked at the House of Ruth and I had worked at this battered women's shelter in Utah. And I was like, battered women, oh, what should I do? What do I want? And I was like, you know, remember that hospice work, that death and dying work? I loved that. Let's go back. Let's see if that's it. So I got my first hospice job, and I had an amazing mentor. I was working in an inner city inpatient unit. If anybody knows about an inpatient unit, you know that they rock. They're amazing. And I got this job, and I looked around the room. And when I looked around the room, I noticed something very special. At the time, I was the youngest practitioner in the room. The other chaplains, doctors, nurses, they were much older than I was, because nobody at that point in their life, in their late 20s and their early 30s, thought death and dying was the thing to do. Because part of what you need to do, because people call me all the time and say, like, I'm interested in going in hospice, what do I need to know? And I'm always like, you have to come to terms with your own mortality. You have to face the fact every day when you go to work and you work with clients and patients that could be your mother, your brother, your sister, your cousin, your child. I worked with children. I worked with adults. I worked with women who looked like my mother. I worked with them all. And if you can't come to terms that there but for the grace of God, I myself could be in that bed or my loved one could be in that bed, you cannot have the special magical resilience that you need to do the work day in and day out. So I tell the story of a nurse I worked with, and we were doing a joint visit to elucidate this point, because it was a hospice nurse, my favorite part. Like, you think the hospice nurse has got it. So we're bedside with a woman who is transitioning, which is hospice lingual for alert enough, but on the cusp of actively dying, in her 50s with cancer and 4 teenage children. And I'm saying to her, the children who I did not know, we were on an initial visit, and I said, let's search your heart of hearts and say the things that Dr. Bayak, Ira Bayak would say, the 5 things I love you for, thank you for, please forgive me for, I forgive you for, and goodbye. The 5 things that matter most, because these are the last moments that your mother can even acknowledge your presence. And if we do this right, then I could save you thousands of dollars of therapy in the future. Honest. And I was like holding some tense silence. 4 teenage boys, they weren't making eye contact. They weren't interested in what I had to say. And the nurse who was standing next to me was so uncomfortable with the tension that I created after, in that pregnant pause, after I'd said what I'd said. She said, or not. Or not. You could just not do relationship closure and you know, talk to your mom before she dies. And you could just, you know, not. My husband likes to call this the or not lady. Because she was a hospice nurse. And what I tell the story only to say this or not lady, because it's to explain that even hospice workers have a hard time dealing with this day in and day out. But what I learned was how heart to heart, how authentic, how you're invited into the most intimate moments of people's lives as a doula for the dying, and how meaningful it is, because I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, if I'm involved, it may not be good, but it will be better. And that with the help of God, they can have not, maybe it's not the best, but what we call in hospice lingo, a good death. So 25 years later, what I learned is I didn't find a job. I found a job and a calling.
Or not. That nurse, I wonder if the nurse knows who she is in Tova's story when she says that the nurse says, or not.
Yeah, I mean.
But I totally get it. Yeah, you know, when there's dead air, it's very hard not to fill it.
But if you're like, actually, or like, this is the work that I know, you know, is important and it's hard, but this is the time to do it. And Tova is just a firecracker. So yeah, she wouldn't let that slide. She would definitely be right back with another response.
Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back soon with more stories from The Stoop. We want to thank Maureen Harvey for producing the podcast. Check us out at stoopstorytelling.com for shows, old stories, not old stories, stories from all of our old shows, and workshop info. We'll see you soon.